101.5 FM, Toronto.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and today we're joined by Phil Undergrounds, 6 to 8 p.m. Wednesdays. So, good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Phil.
Also, good afternoon. I'm remembering right. We're also at 5.
Yeah.
That's our,
That's right.
Trade secret. Yeah. So, today we're going to be speaking to Zafar Benghash. And Zafar is an authority on the Middle East, is an authority on Islam, and he's been following, we know, very closely the events, and the big scary events that are unfolding in West Asia involving Iran and everybody else. Iraq, we're going to have to ask about everybody, because U.S. warships are once again sailing into the Mediterranean to see how much trouble they can cause. And they say they're there to see that there's no trouble, which guarantees there's going to be a lot of trouble. I notice the Canadian government has not condemned, said a word, as far as I know, about the assassination of the top peace negotiator for Hamas in Tehran. And there's a great deal of discussion. Most of it that I see about is all in the realm of, oh, what is Iran going to do? And I want to know, why don't we do something? Why isn't a discussion here in the Canadian Parliament where U.S. warships are being sent by our ally, which means we're there too, and to do what? Instead, everybody waits for, they said, oh, I wonder what a violation of international law, terrorism, carried out by a state, should draw condemnation. There's not a peep out of the prime minister, not a peep out of the opposition, because they're loyal soldiers ready to go for the U.S. empire. At least that's my theory. I think we're joined by the man himself, Zafar Benghash. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I'm with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just saying, we want to ask you about all these events, the assassination of the Hamas leader, Hezbollah leader in Lebanon, and then in Beirut. Geography is important, I guess, here, Beirut. And also of the Hamas leader and political, the peace negotiator for Hamas in the alleged talks that are taking place. But I wanted also to point out, that now I'm reading the Globe and Mail today. They say the U.S. and allies prepare to defend Israel and the warships are there. And while everyone is asking what the reaction will be from Hezbollah or reaction from Tehran, I'm not hearing any reaction here in Ottawa. I don't hear anything in Britain saying, why are we doing this and why are we supporting a state that carries out political assassinations? That would be kind of my starting point. I'd like to know, I guess, first your reaction in terms of analysis. Has it been determined precisely or factually what occurred in Tehran?
Yes, but before I address that, you are absolutely right in pointing out that here is a rogue state, and the leader of that state, Benjamin Netanyahu, who has carried out not one but two terrorist acts, in clear violation of international law, in clear violation of Chapter 1 or Article 51 of Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter by attacking two sovereign countries, not only attacking two sovereign countries, but attacking their capital cities and assassinating top leaders. These are war crimes and clear violations of international law, yet we find not a pipsqueak of protest from Canadian politicians, American politicians, British politicians, European politicians. In fact, all we hear from some of these politicians is, Iran should exercise restraint. It should not escalate. For God's sake, yes. What would you call these assassinations of top leaders in another country's capital, and yet you call upon the victims to show restraint?
Exactly.
This is the outrageous situation that we are faced with. We also, I think, need to look into why Netanyahu did this at this particular time. We can, you know, discuss that. But first, let me come to the question that you raised as to exactly what happened in Tehran on July 31st. The Islamic Revolutionary Guards and their intelligence agency have carried out a detailed investigation, and what they have concluded is that there was a project file that hit the building from the outside. Now, I'm sure your listeners will recall that a day after the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, who was the head of the political bureau of Hamas and who was visiting Tehran to participate in the inauguration ceremony of Iran's new president, that the New York Times carried a report, and I'm absolutely certain that this was planted by the Israelis, in which they said that, well, Israel, you know, a bomb had been planted in that apartment building under the bed where Ismail Haniyeh was to sleep. This was done 2 months ago. This was a deliberately misleading disinformation campaign in order to, and part of the psychological warfare that Israel is waging in order to create confusion within Iran and to sort of create the impression that there are people in Iran that are working for Israel, and Israel is able to even penetrate so deeply into the most heavily guarded areas of Iran. I personally completely dismiss that New York story. It is an Israeli plant meant to mislead. As I mentioned, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps have said that there was a missile or a projectile that was fired from outside. Now, people that were staying in the same building, it's a huge building, there are other apartments, they said that prior to the missile hitting that room where Ismail Haniyeh was staying, that they heard a hissing sound, a whistling sound, which obviously was a missile going through the air, and then a very loud explosion. And the outer wall of that room was completely blown out, as well as the roof above that collapsed. So eyewitnesses, as well as Iran's own investigation, have established that it was a missile, and obviously a missile that was fired by Israel in connivance with the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I want to point out that as soon as this news erupted, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who was on a visit to Southeast Asia, it's so incredible that these people are not even ashamed of telling lies. He blatantly lied. He said, we didn't know anything about it. We are not part of it. Israel did not inform us. I mean, one has to be a complete dunster to accept such kinds of childish explanations.
Absolutely.
After all, Netanyahu was in Washington, D.C. On July 24th. He lectured the U.S. Congress, these clowns, as one of the Hamas leaders pointed out. And every half a minute, these clowns jumped to their feet to applaud the bald-faced lies that Netanyahu was telling. Even CNN was moved to point out that Netanyahu was lying over there, and yet these clowns were standing up and applauding. And obviously, Netanyahu not only met Biden, he also met Kamala Harris, the Democratic Party nominee, as well as Donald Trump, and Pentagon and State Department officials. And it is absolutely certain that the green light was given by the United States that we can carry out these terrorist acts. Mm-hmm. Now, when we see, now let's link it to the fact that the U.S. 3 days ago announced that it was sending its Navy ships, more aircrafts and frigates and aircraft carriers, etc., to defend Israel, as if Israel is the victim, for God's sake.
Yes.
So you see that we are beginning to see all of these forces being exposed for what they are. They have committed war crimes. The Zionists have committed war crimes, and America, Britain, France, all of these people are fully backing it. You know, on August the 1st, Russia presented a statement in the UN Security Council to condemn Israeli attacks, both on Beirut as well as on Tehran. And it was backed in the Security Council by Algeria, China, and Iran. The U.S., Britain, and France vetoed even the issuance of a statement to condemn Israel.
Hmm.
So that gives us an indication of exactly how the forces are arraigned and what these forces are all about. And these people, these regimes in the U.S., Britain, France, Israel, etc., they are really enemies of humanity, and they have to be confronted with
absolutely
an equal amount of force in order to put some breaks to their criminal acts.
Yeah. You know, those who've been victimized and attacked, and by the way, Lebanon has been under attack ever since Israel came into existence. They've always reserved the right to just bomb as they wish. They also fly over Lebanese airspace and attack Syria, and this has been permitted to go on, and it's a blasé attitude in the West that they can do that. And once again, this is just kind of the same phenomenon writ large, but I like the fact we have to tie in the reality that Canada and U.S. are partners with Israel. And if they wanted to introduce the word restraint, well, obviously, Tehran and others in the region would be impressed if someone in the West said Israel has to stop doing this. Then it wouldn't fall on them to have to act in defense of themselves. But they actually introduced the word restraint after a murderer assassinated. I love the way they talk about it. He is a Hamas leader, but he was leading the negotiations, the peace negotiations that they claim to believe in, which should have been an automatic, you know, it were Canada, U.S. honest, they would say to Israel, you can't murder someone who's involved in peace talks that we are promoting. But instead, they pretend it didn't happen.
Exactly. In fact, you know, the Qatari prime minister put it very succinctly. He said, you know, we are told that Israel wants to be involved in peace negotiations, to have a ceasefire, to have its prisoners released, etc. But he said, how can you have talk about ceasefire and peace negotiations when one party in the negotiations gets up and murders the other party involved in negotiations?
Yes.
So what kind of a peace is it that you are looking for? And the same thing applies to officials in Canada, in the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, all of these so-called leaders of the civilized world. You know, and I'm reminded of Netanyahu's statement when he was speaking in Congress, and he said, well, this is a conflict between civilization and barbarism. And obviously he was referring to himself,
yes,
representing civilization. Well, yes. I'm really surprised I've yet to see a civilization that would murder 39,000 plus innocent people. In fact, Lancet's estimate is that at least 186,000 people have probably been killed in Gaza. This was a study they published on July the 7th.
Yes.
And the civilization whose soldiers rape Palestinian prisoners. You know, a few days ago...
Oh, boy. Yes, go on.
Can you imagine that, you know, these people went over there, these right-wing Zionist fascists, they attacked the prison where these Israeli soldiers were held. In fact, the reports that I have read, that there was one prisoner that was gang raped by 9 or 10 Israeli prisoners. And he was in such a bad physical state that he had to be rushed to hospital to be operated upon. And here you have these people that call themselves civilized and part of a civilization, attacking prison to get these prisoners released because their civilization allows the rape of prisoners. Their civilization allows the killing of innocent children. Their civilization allows the killing of
yes.
the women and, you know, destroying the whole of Gaza Strip. Virtually every building in Gaza has been destroyed. And their civilization allows for the starvation of people, 2.3 million people in Gaza. So if that's their civilization, I'm going to declare on your radio that I'm not, I wish to have no part of that civilization.
Yes.
I'd rather be called a barbarian.
No, you know, it goes back to the old, just the colonial mind. Those who were not part of the European project to dominate the world were subhuman. And well, I'm sure you're familiar with a kind of an old joke now, but it was told years ago that Gandhi was asked what he thought about Western civilization, and he said he thought it'd be a good idea.
Exactly.
It's just, you know, a simple observation by people who are being walked on by white supremacists who believe that they are carrying some great mission and can do that. And by the way, the mission involved taking everything the other guy owns, his land, his wealth, everything, and his civilization, and devouring it. I mean, that's the ugly reality.
Yeah.
We're speaking to Zafar Bengash, and there is news, and I guess sometimes the small stories are involved in these things are also helpful to understand. They say that the Jordan has done something rare. They've sent a mission to Tehran, and I wonder. I want to ask you: is it possible that Jordan, who last time there was an attack where they assassinated Iranian personnel in Lebanon, and Iran did respond heavily. The Jordanians permitted Israel to use their airspace, U.S. and Israel. Maybe it was the U.S., actually. I wonder if Jordan might be saying, we won't do that again.
I think there is that possibility because a few days ago, the Jordanian foreign minister had a phone conversation with his Iranian counterpart. And then yesterday, he was in Tehran, which is rare because this is at least the first time probably in more than a decade that a Jordanian diplomat has visited Tehran. And what the Jordanian foreign minister said in Tehran was, he said that I'm not here to deliver a message from Israel, nor am I here to take a message from Iran to Israel. I'm here on behalf of the King of Jordan, and we would like to emphasize that what Israel has done is that we wish to have no part of it. And in fact, he also announced that Jordan is going to, or actually one of the municipalities in Amman, they said that they're going to name a street after Ismail Haniyeh, the martyred leader of Hamas. So I think that's a step in the right direction. And I hope that Jordan would not be a party to this crime again, as they were.
I would be very surprised if they did that. I mean, if they were to once again let the U.S. use their airspace, I could, you know, because you run out of choices when you do that.
Because exactly.
They say
last time when Israel had carried out an attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, that obviously forced Iran to retaliate on April the 13th. As you pointed out, Jordan had allowed its own airspace to be used both by Israel as well as by the United States to intercept Iranian missiles coming towards Israel. Of course, many of them got through, and the two Israeli air bases, the Nevatim Air Base and Ramon Air Base, were targeted in Israel because these were the bases from which Israeli planes had flown that had bombed the Iranian consulate in Damascus, resulting in the death of a senior Revolutionary Guards commander as well as five, six of his colleagues. But this time we hope that Jordan would do the right thing, although I will have my reservations because Jordan is a colonial construct. What Jordan also is concerned about is that more than 50% of its population comprises people of Palestinian origin. We must not forget that Jordan was part of historic Palestine.
Yes.
That the British carved out of and created this, called the Transjordan, and handed it over to one of the sons of Sharif Hussein of Mecca, who was betrayed by the British, and in order to pacify him, they created this so-called kingdom for them. But I'm afraid Jordan's role historically has been very, very dubious. Just to give you one example, before the October 1973 war between Egypt, Syria, and Israel, a meeting had been called in Cairo to which Jordan's King Hussein was also invited, and he was told that Syria, Egypt, and Jordan, they invited Jordan to participate in liberating Syrian and Egyptian territory. And what this man, King Hussein, did was, as soon as he went back to Amman, he contacted the Israelis and told them that this is what Egypt and Syria were planning. Mm. Of course, the Israelis, in their arrogance, didn't take it seriously, because for the previous 2-3 years, Anwar Sadat had been issuing similar threats that this is the year of decision, we are going to liberate our land, etc., and then nothing would happen. So the Israelis thought that, you know, Anwar Sadat is bluffing as usual, and they were sleeping when the Egyptian army and the Syrian army went into liberating the Sinai Peninsula and parts of Golan Heights. But then, of course, America intervened at that time, and the fortunes were reversed. But I was pointing out to the despicable role that King Hussein played at that time, and of course today his son, called King Abdullah, I don't think that they're going to do anything honorable. They might just say this tonight, but you know, it's not in their nature. It's
not in their DNA.
Exactly.
Yes, we're speaking to Zafar Ben-Yash. I better ask about the other parties in the region. Another country that's being talked about, and actually the Israelis are linking this, and I may as well ask you about both, Iraq, Turkey. Erdogan, as usual, is rather like Hussein, but well, he's I guess the word is dubious, odd figure in history. But he's been very loud now over this assassination, and the Israelis are saying to him, you're going to end up like Saddam. And the Iraqis are a factor here. Could you talk about both those countries and how they're reacting?
Sure. I think, as you rightly pointed out, Erdogan is very good at rhetoric, but the reality is very different. If he were serious, he would stop supplying oil to Israel. I mean, he's still supplying oil to Israel. He takes it from the Kurds in Iraqi Kurdistan, and then he sells it to the Israelis. Secondly, he's also, although he has announced that Turkey has cut off its shipment of other goods to Israel, that has probably been reduced slightly, but not completely cut off. But the major issue is the supply of oil. If Erdogan were to cut off oil supplies to Israel, and these are going through the land route because the Ansarullah in Yemen have already shut down the Red Sea lanes for ships going into Israel, and the Israeli port of Eilat has virtually been shut down because there is no work over there, no ships are coming, no ships can leave, and that's largely because of the Ansarullah of Yemen. So Erdogan can do the honorable thing, but I doubt very much if he would do it. As far as Iraq is concerned, it is part of the resistance axis, along with Hezbollah, Iran, and Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And Iraq is participating fully. In fact, if a full-scale war were to break out in the region, I wouldn't rule out that hundreds of thousands of Iraqi militias members would come into Lebanon to participate in the war against Israel. In any case, I don't think that Hezbollah really needs any manpower from outside because Hezbollah has at least 100,000 members as very well trained, very motivated.
And plenty of recruits. They're never short of people who want to join.
Absolutely. And in fact, the commander, Fawad Shukr, who was martyred on July the 30th in South Beirut suburb, he was one of their top commanders. He had trained a generation of fighters under his command, all very highly motivated. And in fact, Fawad Shukr was also a very modest man, despite all of his great achievements. He was involved in all operations against Israel, so he knew exactly what how Israelis behave, what their psychology is. And, of course, you know, they were able to defeat Israel not once but twice, first time in the year 2000 and the second time in 2006. And I can tell you that Hezbollah fighters are highly motivated. In addition to that, I also want to point out that if there were a full-scale war or war between Israel and if Israel were to attack Lebanon, first of all, the Israeli army is deeply depleted after 10 months of war in Gaza. I mean, this is something that the Israeli military commanders themselves have admitted. Yesterday's report in Israeli newspaper said that Israel has lost something like 10,000 soldiers, dead or wounded, in this war on Gaza. And that their soldiers are exhausted because Israel's traditional strategy is to wage short, swift wars and overwhelm their opponents by massive firepower. But this time, you know, Gaza has gone on for 10 months and the Palestinian resistance movement has not been defeated. They still continue to carry out operations against Israeli occupation forces. Even yesterday, you know, the Islamic Resistance fired a number of missiles into what is referred to as southern Israel. And also, Hezbollah has today, as opposed to or compared to the year 2006, when at that time Hezbollah had about 15,000 missiles and Katyusha rockets. These missiles were of short range. Today, Hezbollah has more than 150,000 missiles, some of them of you know, very long range. So every part of Israel is within their range. And this is, you know, not my assessment. This is, in fact, the assessment of America's intelligence agencies, their assessment. This was reported by Hudson Institute a few days ago. They said that if there is a war between Israel and Hamas, Israel and Hezbollah, that there is no way that Israel can win that war, but that Israel is going to suffer massively, both economically as well as militarily.
Which is why they would require their big friends in London, Paris, and Washington to find an excuse to come.
Exactly.
To save them.
What this indicates is that, you know, the deployment of these forces, and there are, of course, British and American special forces operating alongside Israeli forces in Gaza.
Yeah, the British base is in Cyprus, right?
Yes, of course, and there's also a British base in Jordan, along with an American base. So you can see that these people have their bases. Of course, you know, America has its bases as well as the British in other parts of the Middle East as well, whether it's UAE or these Saudi Arabia and these other places. Although I think the Saudis would probably want to wait this out because they don't want to expose themselves too much. That would be very detrimental to their interests. But there are, of course, these Western powers, allies of Israel, have military bases over there, and they will continue to use them. And, of course, there is the one in Socotra, which is in the Indian Ocean, just off the coast of Oman. Again, there is a British base over there, and there is also a United Arab Emirates base over there. And these are likely to be used for if there were any full-scale war erupting in the region. Although, I personally think there is already a full-scale war because Israel is continuing its genocidal policy in Gaza. So that is a full-scale war. But when we're talking about a full-scale war, we're talking about a regional eruption, which would include, of course, Lebanon, Yemen, Iraq, and Iran, and possibly Syria. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of scenario that appears to be evolving. But let me also point out that all these ships, et cetera, that the U.S. is sending to the Mediterranean to help their Israeli ally, aircraft carriers may have, a lot of aura about them, but they are very vulnerable as well. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be sunk so long as they're, the aircraft carrier's runway is damaged, then that aircraft carrier is put out of commission because the planes cannot take off anymore.
Yes.
And that's all it takes. It doesn't have to be sunk. So you can begin to see that, you know, the Americans, despite all of their bravado, are not really all that great, all that sort of, capable of doing the kind
of thing. Awfully hard to imagine the mission beyond. I mean, to be used for what? Because that is not a region that can be occupied.
Exactly.
You can damage it, but you can't occupy it.
Exactly. We have ample evidence of that. We saw, America tried to subdue Afghanistan for 20 years, and then as somebody pointed out, after spending $1.26 trillion, they brought the Taliban back to power.
Yes.
So that's not a very good investment, to say the least.
Taliban didn't have an air force, and they didn't have ships.
Nothing.
They wouldn't fight fair. we're speaking to Zafar Benghazi, and there are two major matters I want to make sure we ask you about. One is the pogroms that are taking place in England as we speak, and I know you watched these matters closely. And then, of course, there's the matter of Imran Khan. You could take them in whichever order you like. I understand Mr. Khan has... it's been 1 year now. He's in prison, and they are talking. And all the headlines today said that are playing up the fact that he said he's not against having a good army. maybe we can start with him.
Yes, of course. As you rightly pointed out, today is the first anniversary of his imprisonment. In fact, he was kidnapped from his home, and all kinds of bogus charges were leveled against him. And over the course of several months when these matters went into the superior courts, fortunately, most of the judges were able to stiffen their spine and rule according to the law, and they have dismissed all of the charges against him. Now, what the way I think it's important to understand exactly what has transpired in the last week or 10 days, it was the military leadership that sent emissaries, in fact, the top generals to Imran Khan to say, well, you know, we need to sit down and negotiate with you. We need to get out of this mess that we have got ourselves into. Because Pakistan is in deep trouble right now, economically, politically, socially, etc. And what the generals had asked for was that if Imran Khan were to spare 9 top generals and not, you know, bring charges against them, because these generals have committed treason, yes, they have basically violated the constitution, and Pakistan's constitution, Article 6 says that that is treason, and if they are charged in a court of law, then they should be executed. So these generals are terrified because they know that they have committed treason. So Imran Khan's reply to them was, he said, well, you can take your case to court and establish your innocence. I'm nobody to sort of give you a certificate of innocence because, you know, I don't believe in that. I want to operate strictly within the bounds of law. Secondly, he said that I'm not opposed to Pakistan having a good army. My point is this, and this is something that they don't mention. He said, look, I want the army to confine itself to its constitutional role. Mm. And if it confines itself to its constitutional role, I'm all for the army.
The of country course.
That the environment that we are living in, we can't do without an army. And the political and military leadership have to be on the same page. I'm not opposed to that. My point is, that not the army, the judiciary, the politicians, everybody has to act according to the law and according to the role that has been assigned to them by the Constitution. You do that, we have said, I have no problem with anybody. And as far as the generals are concerned, if they have done something wrong, they have to take their case to the court of law. I cannot exonerate anybody. That's mm-hmm. not my style. I won't do it. That's not something that, you know, unfortunately, the Pakistani media wishes to let people know, or other media outlets, they keep on talking about, oh, Imran Khan wants to have a deal with the army. No, he has not said that he wants to have a deal with the army. He said mm-hmm. he respects the army so long as it operates within the bounds of law and the limits set for army's role in the constitution. So that's what he has said.
Yes.
And unfortunately, like, you know, it's so incredible that in Pakistan, the entire media is controlled by the military. They have spent billions of rupees bribing journalists. And unfortunately, there are a lot of journalists that are willing to sell their souls for a shoulder of mutton.
It's not an uncommon phenomenon in the world.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, there are some vloggers that produce programs from outside Pakistan. These are people of Pakistani origin. These are some retired military officers. The others are, you know, longtime journalists, etc. And about, there are probably maximum of about 12 people. I mean, the army is so terrified of them that the army, retired army officers, they have court-martialed in absentia, accusing them of creating sedition by asking for the army to revolt against its leadership. One of these vloggers resides in Toronto as well. And all these people have been saying is to the army officers, because they have, you know, they know their friends are still in the army, or they know other people, etc. They say, you should abide by the oath that you took when you became commissioned officers. Mm-hmm. And your oath was that you will work according to the Constitution. Number two, that you will obey only lawful orders that are issued by your superiors. And number three, that you will not interfere in politics. This is an oath that every officer takes upon getting their commission. And yes. these people have been pointing out to their fellow, you know, soldiers in the armed forces that, look, this is the oath that you took. You need to uphold that oath. Why are you accepting illegal orders of these senior officers who are all thoroughly corrupt, who are mm-hmm. dishonest, who have become billionaires, who have bought properties all over the world, whether in England, France, or Canada, or Australia, or America? They said, please don't join them. Think of your oath, think of your country.
Yeah, they need a patriotic army.
Exactly, absolutely. In fact, there are, you know, most of the people in Pakistan today, 2-3 years ago, they used to think that the Pakistan Army was a very great institution. Because of the fact that the army had, done so much massive propaganda about its patriotism, about its sacrifices. But in the last 2-3 years, because of their behavior, they have become so exposed that now almost everybody realizes that the real problem is their army, or at least the leadership,
absolutely,
the top generals in the army, and they have to be got rid of.
Yeah, that's a very important statement. This is Zafar Benkash. We're very fortunate to be able to talk to Zafar about these things. Zafar, I wonder if I could ask you, you must be watching closely this phenomena of the fascists in Britain who are targeting immigrants and people of color and Muslims. And there is a tie, we notice, between one of the most vocal leader, the man Robinson, and his passion for Israel. Of course, I'm loading the question. I'll ask you, what the heck is going on?
Yes. You see, last week, there was an incident in Southport where a person killed three children. They were involved in some activities. And immediately, the propaganda was that this was an immigrant, an illegal immigrant who had carried this out, and that he was a Muslim. And the central figure in this whole thing was this character, Tommy Robinson, who is actually an absolute fascist, a racist and a bigot.
Yes.
And he's also, incidentally, deeply aligned with the Zionists.
Yes, he sees Israel as the first line of defense against people of color.
Exactly.
And non-Christians.
Correct. And he's the one who is leading this these racist attacks against Muslims, attacking mosques, attacking Muslims in various areas. And he's blaming, although the British police themselves have said that, the person who carried out those attacks is not a Muslim. The judge had to release his name, although he was, not 18 yet. He'll turn 18 in a few days. But he said in order to put this matter to rest so that people would know that it was not a Muslim, they found out that he was a Rwandan, but he's not a recent refugee or anything. He had been in Britain for many, many years. So why he did it, we don't know, but that's something that has to be...
Crime happens in messed up economies with no prospects.
Exactly. So, and Britain, of course, is falling apart. Politically, economically, the situation is extremely, extremely bad for Britain. People can hardly make ends meet. And so
you blame the foreigner.
Exactly. They always blame the foreigners. They say, well, this is what, these foreigners have come, they've stolen our jobs, etc. Whereas, in fact, the rich in Britain are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And so, basically, this also ties in with the Zionist agenda, because there have been massive, massive demonstrations in Britain against the Israeli genocide. And as we know, at least 20 candidates, independent candidates, were elected to the British Parliament who were supportive of the Palestinian rights.
Yes.
And that terrified the British establishment. So they basically are behind this whole thing to instigate, riots against Muslims, to use these Zionist agents like Tommy Robinson.
Yes.
And his ilk. These are basically fascist elements who do not hesitate to indulge in violence and to target, racial minorities, religious minorities, etc.
And by the way, despite the lame, worthless quality of the British Labour Party, there have been plenty of people willing to fight these fascists. It's not as though they're having their way. There's no question that the resistance to them is quite powerful.
Yes, of course, because you see, there are people in Britain. I think there is a lot more awareness in Britain among ordinary people today as to what is taking place. And I'd have to say that overall, the British media is very good. I mean, when you have although they're not 100% pure, but still they provide quite a bit of context and information, media outlets like The Guardian, The Independent, etc. I'm not talking about the right-wing media, but at least
yes,
they sort of, the more what would one would refer to as the liberal media, that they do provide context and proper information, and they have, you know, alternative voices being raised over there. So the British people, by and large, are quite aware of the reality, and that's why you have this pushback from them against these fascist elements, that they're not going to allow their country to be hijacked by them. And, of course, these fascists are a minority. They're not a majority, but since they are backed by very powerful forces, that's why they're able to get their voice amplified and, you know, their propaganda given a platform in order to target, you know, ethnic and religious minorities in Britain.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Zafar, it's been a great time talking to you because all these, you managed to cover all these important matters very, very well. We do appreciate it very much.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you for the opportunity. Okay.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Zafar Bangash, there's a voice you can trust. He knows what he's talking about. He's been to all these places and is a great scholar.